You know, why is everybody on the internet right now? You should be out on a hike. Mm-hmm. I'm taking notes on a piece of paper in this session. So I guess I'll start with one that's super simple. All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. That is the major tenet of the Earth Seed Religion in the book, The Parable of the Sower and the Parable of the Talents. It was written by Octavia Butler in 1993 and has since gone on, especially this last year, to be a New York Times bestseller book, which was one of the lifelong dreams that Butler had. Hmm. Today, we are going to talk about theopoetics in the world of Octavia Butler, specifically the Parable series. I'm going to give a quick overview about theopoetics, which means I probably need that pointer that I put, I don't know where, here's. Just so we can get here. Is anybody, is this their first session? Okay, yeah, we always have new people, so I always want to review so people kind of have a sense of a context of where we're going to go. And then I'm going to talk about Butler's work, and then I'm going to talk about the Parable series and how I think it's a theopoetic response. And then we'll open up to questions and conversation. And we'll do this kind of Earthseed style. So in the communities of Earthseed, someone would gather and talk and bring up an idea, and then it would be given to the community. It wasn't like a sermon, like, here's the word, and then everybody goes away. No, they challenged it, they pushed back, they gave more wisdom. And so that's how we're going to conduct this session. So let me see if I can... You're going to see some of what we talked about. No, not that one. Now that doesn't sound like... That sounds like somebody is playing with a bell. So just for review, the first day we talked about theopoetics is influenced by three main events. The Nonprofit Society for Arts, Religion, and Contemporary Culture that was started by the likes of Paul Tillich and the first director of the Modern Museum of Art in New York. We talked about consultations and hermeneutics being the study of interpretation, and the way in which they sought to ask questions about how we talk about God through experience. And it was greatly influenced by the Death of God movement. So you had these conversations about the centering of arts, the centering of experience when talking about God, and the context of Christianity being on the decline and the notions of Christian responses to atheistic proclamations, right? That was the world in which Stanley Hopper coined the term. Many of the scholars in theopoetics came from various fields, but they all agreed that the important way for us to discuss the divine is to engage aspects of aesthetic, imaginative, creative, artistic, and embodied practices. Also, each of these areas represent the need to understand God in a new way, and to move from rigid systems to one where imagination and the arts are centered. So basically focusing and saying that there is more than one way to talk about God. Theopoetics is it helps us to understand one way to do that. Second day, we talked about the definition of theopoetics, and we talked about theopoetics as an emphasis of style and a positive concern for the intersection of religious reflection and spirituality, with its focus on aesthetics, imagination, and the arts, centered on creative embodiment, and the ways that affirm community and material change. And we went through different iterations of how different scholars have utilized various aspects of this definition in their context. We went through a working definition about how theopoetics becomes a modifier and a mode. Modifier and a mode in a way that allows us to understand how certain theologies help us to understand those creative embodied practices, especially as it leads to liberation, and also how it also can serve as a corrective for other forms and ways that theology moves us away from those creative embodied practices. Lastly, we talked about methodology. And I introduced a four-point method that I use in my research. The first being socially locating both myself and the object or the trace that I'm investigating. of doing the radical inquiry work of making sure that I am listening to the voices that are both at the center of that investigation and that I've been marginalized. Asking the God question, which means I'm going to ask with my tradition and what God says about this thing, but I'm also going to allow that thing to have voice and speak back to say something about how we relate to God and to one another. And finally, responding artistically, meaning that the things that we are engaging, they inspire some kind of creative, embodied, artistic responses. And so those were the 2 days. And then the third day, which I'm going to scroll by real quick to get to the last slide, we talked about case studies, different projects, both liturgically and centered on justice and centered in pedagogy, that allow us to understand how we move into the doing of theopoetics in community. And so today we're going to talk about butter. So that is a review. Just also as a review for the first timers, this PowerPoint will be available to you, so you don't have to worry about taking all of the notes. There's a sign-up sheet that we have here if you want access to this PowerPoint. And also there is a book list that we have been compiling since the beginning of the week that we have. So those are books that were mentioned both in the presentation and in our discussions. So if you would like those, they'll be up here. We'll move them down probably to the center circle for you to grab a copy of the book list and sign your name for the PowerPoint.
Is there any sense at all of closing some of the doors or windows so the scribal situation is less distracting?
We have to consult the medics. They need the flow of air because we are inside. Okay. So that's why the door is open. I hope that will be done in a bit. I will keep going. Would you like me to?
No, I can all work hard to focus.
Okay.
I really want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I'll go slow and we'll repeat a lot and you may have questions, and if there's any point you're like, all right, you're explaining that one thing and I was listening to the drum and can you read? Happy to. That's okay. Why we're here.
Thank you.
Octavia Butler, do we have anyone here who is familiar with Octavia Butler's work? Okay, one, two, we got a little bit of hands. Okay, anybody that has never heard of her before? Great. Except from this moment.
That, well, yeah.
Before this week. Yes, anyway. No, so Octavia Butler is a science fiction writer. She's hailed as, has anybody heard of the term Afrofuturism? So when you think about Lovecraft Country, when you think about musicians like Janelle Monae and what's the spaceship? George Clinton, the spaceship.
Oh, yeah,
Parliament.
Yeah, yeah.
And you think about groups like Sun Ra in Chicago in the 60s. That's all part of Afrofuturism. Afrofuturism is a way in which the Black community sees and writes themselves into the future. And this idea was adopted because when you look at the history of science fiction, science and speculative fiction, it has been predominantly dominated by white male tropes, right? And so even the way we thought about our futures didn't have Black people in them. In fact, I'm going to go to a different quote where Octavia Butler actually talks about this. And if you give me a moment, because there we go. Really? You have never done this little thing. Okay. Butler is, in this article that she is talking, she is writing about another science fiction writer, and I was trying to find his exact words, but there's another science fiction writer, and he talks about his work in writing and why there is no need to talk about Black people, how it just complicates things. And how I really want to get his exact words, and I read 50 different articles this morning, so that probably wasn't a good thing to do. Articles I'd already written. and I cannot find it, so I will paraphrase. It's fine, I'll find it later. The science fiction writer thought that including a black, which is how he indicated, would just complicate the story and put all the focus on that person and not the story. He says, if you want to talk about diversity, then, you know, you can just write about aliens and it'll achieve the same thing, right? And so Butler responds to him and she talks about how this points to the otherness, right, that is so predominant in science fiction. And she talks about why she writes about black women as a way to write herself into her stories and as a way to offer a critique to that notion that adding black people into stories will immediately only make that story about race. And so when you read a lot of her work, there are aspects in which she does write about race specifically, and there are aspects where the storyline is about some kind of racial context, but especially when you get to something like Parable, the brilliance of Butler is that, bless you, is that she doesn't necessarily write only about race. Her characters are racialized in many ways. You'll mention them saying, you know, they're from certain backgrounds, and most of her leads in her stories are usually women of color, mostly black women, but she doesn't write it with race being the center. And so for this reason, there has been some argument about whether or not she truly is a mother of Afrofuturism, because she doesn't only write about African American culture and context, but that has been debunked by several scholars who note her brilliance in talking about different aspects of what it means to survive in a context as a person that is oppressed without necessarily hitting the nose, you know, being on the nose about race. So that's just some context there. She was actually born in Pasadena, California, where I currently reside, born and raised there. And she started writing science fiction when she was about 12 or younger, maybe 9. And it all was because she saw a really bad science fiction movie on TV called Something About Going to Mars. And she was like, it was terrible. And when I watched it, they said, anybody can write like that. I mean, I can write something better than that. I will write something better than that. And that's how she started writing science fiction. And she was a very quiet child. She was an only child to her mother and her father. Her father passed away early on. And her mother worked as a maid. And her aunts and uncles worked, they all worked for the same white family. And she talks about some of the ways that she had to deal with her mom being a maid. And early on how she kind of resented and didn't understand, but then she realized the context in which her mom was trying to raise her and to support her and to, you know, it was a note of survival. And for those of you who've come to any of the morning sessions, have heard a lot about motherhood and survival and what it means and what it is that you have to do. And so she worked through a lot of that in her interviews. But she wrote her, she got paid for her first short story in the early 60s, and when she was going to Pasadena City College and got a chance to go on one of those, I can't remember the writing workshop, but it was a really popular writing workshop with a lot of famous writers. She was invited there and then was mentored, and through those directions became Octavia Butler. One of her her first main stories is called Kindred. Has anybody read Kindred? Okay, does anybody know? Well, Kindred, I'll explain. Kindred is a time travel novel, which is an interesting take on time travel. It is about a young black woman whose name is Dana. And she is mysteriously pulled back in time to the antebellum South. And she encounters a young white man and she saves his life. And she begins through a series of events to realize that this is her ancestor. And she has to ensure that he stays alive long enough, essentially, to rape her great-great-great-grandmother to ensure her own existence. She is married to a white man, and there are parts in the novel where they're pulled back together, where he then has to pretend to be her owner for her protection. Butler wrote this as a response to a person in class who was basically saying he didn't understand how people back in the day didn't, you know, I wouldn't have stood for any of this stuff that they went through, and I would have, you know, and she quotes how this is a very, she didn't like the comment because it was very presumptuous in what people had to do to survive. And she was saying, you don't know what you would do if that happened to you. And so this was very much a response of, okay, what would happen if somebody in the 70s when she was writing was forced to go back in time and have to deal with that context and those circumstances? This is very big in science fiction, right? People aren't really talking about this stuff at the time. The only other major African-American writer at the time of her writing was Samuel Delaney. And so she really began to make a name for herself. She's written several other series, including the Pattern Master series, which also deals with really cool gods and notions and different things like that, which I highly commend to you. Wild Seed, Lilith's Brew, which is also a really interesting series. It's about, has anybody read Lilith's Brew? So Don, yeah? Okay. Lilith's Brew is essentially about this black woman who wakes up in a holding room, and she realizes that she has been captured by an alien species. And what she comes to find out is that the Earth has basically, humans have basically destroyed themselves in war, global war. And these aliens come by and they see what happened, and they take all of the people who were, all the humans who survived into their ship, and they put them in these pods and put them to sleep, and they begin to regenerate the Earth. And so they're looking for a human to lead a group of humans to go down to repopulate the Earth, because the Earth is all different now. Everything on the Earth is different since it's been regenerated without humans. But part of the deal is that this particular species, the way it survives, is that it mates with another species and then becomes something totally different. And so what the humans are propositioned with is that they must mate with this species, and then their offspring will neither be human or the alien species. And so she gets paired with one of the Uankali, I believe is what they're called. And they're in these really super interesting conversations about the Uankali's observation of humanity. And so this is where she incorporates her idea of the role of intelligence and hierarchical behavior. So she says the two things in combination that have been lethal to humanity has been hierarchical behavior, which she says is, you know, one ancient kind of way when you think about, she talks about like mosques taking over a land, of like one will win out and the other, right? That is like nature. But intelligence, which is relatively a new thing and a more human thing, the combination of those two things became lethal. And so this is what the Uankali observes about humanity. Like, this is what led to their demise, essentially. It's really interesting. It has notions of technology and what does it mean to be human, and it's fascinating. Most of her work sits in a little bit of a dystopian world. But the way in which she's able to create these worlds, which feel a little too real in our imagination, it isn't without hope. When she writes, she is very observant about what is going on in the world around her, and she is trying to find other ways of being that we may be able to relate to one another better so that we can heal our world, essentially. She's trying to save the world through her writing. The Parable series, which is the story of a young black girl who's a teenager who lives in Robdello, which technically is Pasadena. She bases the city in the Parable series off of the city of Pasadena where she grew up. It's about a young girl who lives in this town. It's a walled community. It's 2024, and everything has gone crazy. The wage gap and the wealth gap is incredibly wide, so much so that the community that she's in is basically, they're like poor, but they're not out on the streets without food or protection poor. And so their wall that they have around their city gives them some security, and they have like some kind of jobs, but they're in no means some of the upper, larger, bigger cities, which, by the way, are owned by corporations. So corporations own full cities. Slavery is, I don't want to say slavery has returned, because we can have conversations about how I never left, but in the iteration of its presence in the novels, it is partnered with technology. So they have slave colors, which can be controlled by remote control, and that's how they control the slaves in these major cities. What else? So it's about this young girl named Lauren. She's about 15, and when she begins to talk about, you know what, I'll let her, hey, turn it up on. I got this Kindle a couple weeks ago, and I need you to Kindle one.
You swipe up.
Yeah. There is a button. Thank you.
I was like, where is he?
Okay. So it's 2024, and this young girl is getting ready to be baptized. And this is important because she talks about the day of her baptism. Each of the books start with a verse, as it will, from the books of the living, which is the Bible, essentially, of the Earthseed religion. And so this one starts with, a gift of God may sear unready fingers. And so she talks about, at least 3 years ago, my father's God stopped being my God. His church stopped being my church. And yet today, because I am a coward, I let myself be initiated into that church. I let my father baptize me in all three names of that God who isn't mine anymore. My God has another name. And so she begins to describe both the conditions of the world in this moment and the conditions religiously in this shift that she is feeling away from her father, who is a Baptist minister. Important thing to know is Octavia Butler actually identifies as a former Baptist. That's what she says in her own words. And so as Lauren, they're riding their bikes outside of their city into this space, she begins to describe the neighborhoods and how it's just extremely poor. So you have little kids who are covered in dirt and are naked, and they're just standing there looking at them. You see bodies of people that have been raped and tortured and killed on the side of the road. The family that goes, they have to travel in packs, and they always have to be armed because of so much of the violence that is eschewed in that space. And then she also begins to talk about her own disability. So Lauren has a disability called hyperempathy syndrome, which means that she shares the pleasure and pain of all that she sees. And so this syndrome within the book becomes a tool of manipulation, because in the cities where they have slavery, for those who have hyperempathy syndrome, they are more coveted because they're easier to be controlled. So if I had hyperempathy syndrome and me and Kathy were in it together and we both get in trouble, the slave owner can hit Kathy, and all I have to do is see it, and I feel the actual fullness of whatever was done to her. So it's easier to control people with hyperempathy syndrome. And because of this reason, Lauren has to keep it secret. They can't tell anybody because that makes her weak, right? But at the same time, she's describing all of these things and how she has to look away because she can't look at the pain because she can't help but feel it. Right? She can't get away from the feeling of it. Even if she sees somebody bleed, she will start to bleed even if she has no injury, right? And so she describes the scene of going to this one standing church, because her father's church was burned down with all of the homeless people in it, and being baptized in the name of a God that she no longer believes. And she begins to believe that her God is a God of change. God is change, the tenet I told you earlier. She has a session of parliament where she talks about, sorry, I should learn to use a Kindle. Notes.
making the sounds of the things. I'm like, doo, 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 doo. Here we are. So, a tenet from God. This is a tenet from the Earth Sea. She says, we do not worship God. We perceive and attend God. We learn from God. With forethought and work, we shape God. In the end, we yield to God. We adapt and endure, for we are Earth Sea, and God is change. And so she begins to talk about the notion of how the shifts and the flows of God creating the universe and us being the seed that is planted that now has agency and power to shape and to change and to understand what those ebbs and flows of change are. That's where she begins to situate and understand her own theological and religious expression in the world. The town is destroyed by people who are on this drug called pyro, and it makes people want to set things and people and stuff on fire. And so they just go around and they burn everything. So her town is destroyed, her family is lost, and she must travel to find a home. And it's during this time that she actually has to dress like a man to protect herself, right? And she has to travel, and she's traveling with two people from her community, and they begin to meet different people on the road, and it's during this time that she learns to survive on her own and also to spread her idea of Earthsea. And so the book goes through all these different conjunctions of her survival, and it actually ends with them establishing a community in a space in Northern California, similar to something like The Village, right? Mm-hmm. Cabins, there's a space to teach the children. They initiate that space by taking the seeds that they have collected and planting trees in a ritual of honoring the dead that they have lost on the way to this space. And they begin to create this ritual Earthsea community. And so this book and the second book gets all super, super complicated. And we'll field questions and talk a little more about it. But this book blew up in terms of like how it resonated in our world, right? One of the reasons that it became really popular is because of her poignant critique on social, political, economic, environmental notions of what was happening. One of the things that Butler used to always do is she always read like the back of the newspaper. She loved reading the news, and she was really fired up about environmental justice and all these different things. And so she began to write, this is what's going to happen if we continue. Now I'll pause there and say, speculative fiction, science fiction, is usually categorized by answering three questions. Either a what if, like what if people can fly? And you write like, a whole story about that idea, right? Or if only, like if only we can go back in time. And then you write a whole story about a possibility if we only could go back in time. Or the final is if we continue. Now most dystopia situates itself in this question. And basically, if we continue on the trajectory that we are without change, this is the world we'll inherit. So that's Handmaid's Tale, right. 1984, think of all the dystopia, Hunger Games, all of those things, right? If we continue to go down this trajectory without change, this is the world we get. And that is exactly the vein that she was writing the parable series in. Mm-hmm. She gets so close to her critique, especially as she integrates the way religion works in politics, right? She says in an interview that she wanted to talk about how religion is a force that humankind has used for change throughout history. She's like, I'm not dictating whether that force is good or bad. What I'm saying is that religion has been a force for change that has been utilized. And so she shows how within this book. She gets so close to the second book, where is a fundamentalist Christian group called American Christianity. And the pastor of that church, the big denomination American Christianity, gets elected to the presidency. And in a speech after he is president, he says, and I quote from the book, this book written in 1998, we need to all come together to make America great again. Right? Now, that isn't new language, right? That was language that was used and employed by Reagan. And so Reagan is actually the president that she is responding to. She very much disliked Reagan and a lot of his policies, but she picked up on the ways in which evangelical thinking was so infused into both the idea, the campaign, the influence, right, of un-American evangelicalism at the time. And so she is responding to a type of evangelicalism that produces this type of response. When that president in the book wins the election, a very extreme sect rises up within American Christianity, and they begin to go into different towns and different places, and people that didn't agree with their type of Christianity, or people that they thought were not Christian, that they condemned as cults, they would go into their towns, they would take their children, they would send their children to American Christianity homes, and they would re-enslave the inhabitants of that town as conversion camps. And so this is what is happening in the book. And so years later, during the time that, you know, she had written the book, people said, do you think it's prophecy? Do you think that this book is prophecy? And she goes, oh, I hope not. I really, really hope not, because her point of writing it was not for it to come true. It's for her to say, right? She's writing to save the world. So she wants us to, like, not do this. Like, this is what not to do, right?
It's a cautionary tale.
Yes, it is very much a cautionary tale. And so in 2016 and also in 2020, when all these things start to happen, people begin to go back and go, wasn't there a book that talked about this? And so then they begin to pick up on Parable of the Sower, and that's when it kind of blows up and it explodes, and then it makes the bestsellers list, and it does all these things. I will say, I'm just blabbing, this is great. Ask questions if you need in between, because I can talk for literally forever about this, so just raise your hand. What's interesting is that this idea of Parable of the Sower was not the original idea of the series. So this series was supposed to be a 6-book series, right? And the original idea was based on environmental justice. So she wanted to write a book about a group of people that were set to colonize another planet. They were set to go and inhabit another planet. And that planet was trying to reject them. And so there are all these biological, neurological, like, torture that these people encounter, because the planet is trying, they're like, we don't want you here. So the planet is trying to get them off. And so she's thinking about this idea, and she's writing to her publicist, and she's like, this is the next big thing. I feel very good about this. And as she is trying to figure out how the people got to this planet, that's when she's asking the questions like, who are these people? What is gonna take a group of people to just go off planet all of a sudden? And that's when she begins to dig into think through ways in which humans evoke change, i.e. religion, i.e. something has happened to get these people off planet. And so these two books begin, it becomes her rabbit trail, how she gets to that third book. She had a lot of difficulty writing these books, a lot of depression. One, because the books were also kind of depressing, but two, she dealt a lot with blood pressure, high blood pressure. And so the medication that she was on was causing her extreme depression. Plus she also was just dealing with a lot of other things. She actually moved up to Seattle in 1999, and I had a chance to actually go see her home when I was in Seattle this week, this past winter, before here. Time is weird. And was given in 95, the MacArthur Genius Grant. So, which was huge for her, because it was really difficult throughout her life to make money off of her writing. She came, she bought a home, life happened. This was a few years after her mother passed, and so she's trying to get back into writing this work, and she's depressed, and she has major writer's block, and she doesn't know how to kind of move forward in the series. So she takes a break, she writes a vampire novel, and then she tries to go back to it, but she has a sudden fall in front of her home in 2006. And she suddenly dies. There are debates about what happened to her. Some say she died as a result of the fall. Others say that she had a stroke, actually, and she died. And still, some say that the stroke caused the fall, which is how she died as a result of her injuries. And so she never finished the series. The most complete version of the series is about 40 to 60 pages and is housed in the Huntington Library, also in Pasadena, where all of her writing, she donated everything. So there's about 8,000 pieces in this collection of everything she's ever written, rewritten, all of the paper clippings. She's very organized. She would clip out all of the paper clippings for her research. She would clip them in these manila envelopes. They had a table of contents. It's wild, just how much she was producing. So that's her story and that's her life. She was an incredible person and incredibly encouraging to other Black writers at the time, mentoring and doing different things of that nature. The impact, yes?
I'm curious of what your dissertation was.
Is? Yeah, I'm still writing, so I'm still here. So the dissertation focuses on Theopoetics and Octavia Butler. So I basically argue that the Earth Seed religion that she creates is a Theopoetic response. And so we think about Theopoetics as this positive concern for aesthetics, imagination, and the arts. We think about it as material change, and when we think about it as embodiment and community, it's really hard to look at the tenets of Earthseed, tenets that talk about God is change, tenets that talk about how partnership is life, tenets that talk about the ways and of moving into diversity and of caring for one another and of caring of the land, right? This other way of being and knowing God, and not call that theopoetic. The reason that that's important, especially for our field, is that theopoetic, though it was originally in some historical context about Christian renewal, theopoetic is not necessarily about Christian religious reflection. It's about religious reflection on the aesthetics, imagination, and the arts, and all these things. And so, because Earthseed isn't Christian, and in fact, is now practiced as an official religion. You can literally go on a website and find a community that practices Earthseed. It helps us to understand what does it mean of engaging different ways of the divine, and how Butler has given us an exemplar of that in her work. And just throughout like the conditions of her work and who she is as an artist. So as an artist, to begin to be able to make critique about culture, right, using their art, but to also to make poignant critiques and observations about the way in which religion is enfolded and folded into those notions of culture, and to offer a different way of being is deeply theopoetic. And so I argue that if we, particularly as Christians, want to learn different ways or examples of different ways of being embodied and engaging the divine, then something like an Earthseed and something like Octavia Butler's work becomes an avenue to do that. And what does that mean for the future of the field? So that's what the dissertation specifically is about. Yes?
Real quick, do you know, was she ever aware in her lifetime that people were actually practicing the religion?
No, you know what's really funny is, when I met the archivist, we had a conversation and I told her I was looking at religion, which she thought was really interesting. And I was like, yeah, because you know, Earthseed is a real religion. And she's like, I'm sorry, what? And I was like, no, did you see this website? And I Googled it, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And she told the family and the family didn't know.
Mm.
And so they freaked out. And they were like, she never intended for it to be an actual religion. She in one of the letters to her publicist, she talks about how normally there's like science fiction lovers, and then there's like Black women, like those are her two like people who read her work, and she knew she was consciously adding a third of like people who studied New Wave and who were part of like New Wave traditions. So that's about as far as we have any evidence of her writing that she knew about it, but she had no indication that this was an actually practiced religion.
Could you say a little bit more about what that is in her writing about Earthseed? I mean, I'm
assuming,
I'm assuming you mean Earthseed, like
Earthseed.
Like, right, like, yeah, like.
Seed.
Yeah, that's why I was trying to pull up like, this
E-A-R-T-H-S-E-A? I mean, like.
No, seed. Like a seed in the ground?
Oh, seed. Earth seed.
So the earth seed and seed.
Sour, get it? Seed.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so
okay,
sort of
earth seed.
And what's interesting, she ends this novel with the passage from the Bible.
Okay, but okay, and so how, so is it in her, is it just, Yeah, I mean, say something about that concept in her work. I haven't read her work. I mean, I mean, how does it inform, for example, the community that is created up in Northern California or something?
Yes. So, yes, I'm going to find this thing, this note. This Kindle is going to let me. So the "all that you touch, all you change" quote that I read before, that is like an anchor tenet of, or okay. That's like our, you know, love your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and, like, that's what that is for Ursine. Okay. So, like, the tenet that God is changed.
Okay.
And so aspects like adaptability, aspects like, okay, maybe this is it. Oh, this is it. Okay, I think I found it. Okay, so I'll read this. My apologies, I am still learning to work this thing. And I highlighted all of these things for you to read. And now I can't really find it. So Ursine is based on the tenet that God has changed. Ursine is based on the tenet that humankind has the agency to shape God, right? When it's paralleled in the book and in other knowings, it's paralleled against the notion that many Christians believe that God is unchangeable, unknowing, God doesn't change. You know that song, God Will Never Change? Right? So it's parallel in the sense that, no, God is chaos, God is clay, God is, you know, movable, infallible. Actually, I think I have that. Keep asking questions.
Was there conversation between, you know, process theologians and, you know, this work, or, you know, I mean, like that?
No, she didn't have. So these were like, when she was writing Ursine, these were like affirmations that she wrote herself that would be posted all over her house with post-its. This wasn't like a, I've dug and I'm taking. So she's taking tenets of Eastern traditions, and actually it's in this book. She explains it in her own words. And that I highlight. So she's taking all of these different notions from different Eastern religions and meditative practices, and she is saying, you know, this is what I think when I think about creating another religion. Like, she talks about writing a religion. I hate technology now.
Did her work influence? I mean, I don't know much about process theology, but I think of people like. But John Cobb, or did they read that? I mean, because it just sounds like what little bit I.
Yeah, so it is very close to process theology, and so is theopoetics. Actually, I believe Hopper and Whitehead went to seminary together, and so Hopper is the one who coined the term theopoetics, and so there is this trajectory between process theology and theopoetics, and there are several process theologians that also consider themselves theopoets. When it comes to process theology and Octavia Butler, my recommendation, and it's not on the, is it on the list? It may be on the list, is Making a Way Out of No Way by Monica Cohen, who is a womanist theologian, and is also a process theologian. She taught at Claremont.
Okay.
And she, when she talks about, at the end of that book, about the importance of community, she talks about Earth Seed.
Okay, oh wow. Cool.
So, yes.
Okay. I am completely and utterly fascinated by the fact that there is like a whole religious community based on Earth. So my question for you is, have you visited and talked with those people in preparation for your dissertation? Like, really fascinated now.
I haven't. I think when I found them, it was like right at the beginning. I stumbled upon Octavia Butler being my dissertation. This was not me. I didn't come into going, this is what I'm going to do. I knew that I wanted to do something with religion and the arts. I know I wanted to be Center on Justice. I got super burned out in 2017, and then I ended up taking a break. Like, I quit all my jobs, and I moved out of my apartment, and I just house hopped for the whole summer. And my only homework was to read fiction and catch up on Game of Thrones. And that's all I did. And the only way I encountered Octavia is, re-encountered her, is they were doing an exhibit of her work at the Huntington. Now, at this time, I didn't know she was born in Pasadena. I didn't know all of her work. I didn't know any of that. And one of the women, a part of the liturgy project we talked about, gave me free tickets to go. And so I go to this exhibit, I get to read some of her journals. And I'm like, why did I stop reading her? I read Kindred, and I just stopped, you know, I was like, oh, her work is great. I'm going to read some more. And, you know, life. So, you know, and I was like, you know, I'm going to pick her back up. Where should I start? And I look up, and there is a poster advertisement for Parable of the Sower. And I was like, oh, well, I'll start there. So I just got the book on my Kindle, and I started reading it, and I was like, why are we talking about this? Have you read this book? This book is so good. Why are we talking about this in our religion classes? We should read this book. And so I said, I'll write a paper. I still wasn't thinking dissertation. I was like, I'll write a paper for my class. And I went to a conference, and I met Ashan Crawley, who is another person that is incredible. He wrote Black Pentecostal Breath, and it's about, it incorporates performance theory, sound theory, queer theory, religion, literature, into his notion about otherwise possibilities, which focuses on like the movement of the Pentecostal experience, right? He's an incredible writer. His latest book is called The Lonely Letters. He's also an accomplished artist, like just an incredible person. Anyway, I saw him sitting by himself in conference and kind of freaked out, and I was like, I'm gonna go talk to him because he teaches in literature. And I was like, oh, hi, I'm a PhD student, and I was wondering. Yeah, you know, like super nervous, and I was like, you know, I really want to write a paper on the theology of Earth Seed because I'm super fascinated by it. And he was like, yeah, you know, I don't think anybody's doing that. And that, my friends, is the Willy Wonka golden ticket of PhD studies. Because when you have an idea and somebody who is well known and established in the field looks at you and says, you know, I don't think anybody is doing that. And then the light bulb went off and I was like, oh, so this could be like more than a paper. And he's like, nice to meet you. Good luck. And I'm like, and then I went home and I started, like, you know, I emailed my advisor and I was thinking about this and then I started Googling and then that's when I found out she was born in Pasadena and I was like, oh, that's freaky. Yeah. And then my advisor responded and was like, yeah, all of her work is at the Huntington and, you know, when you're ABD, you can get a reader. I hope you get a reader's card so you can have access to the archives. And I was just like, oh. So that's how I got in. Kind of like, you know, and so it was just really my own.
But you haven't, like, actually, like,
I haven't reached out to them. No, I haven't reached out to them.
Is that even in your forefront of your mind?
It is. So I do want to do a book on Octavia Butler. I want to do a book on the religion in the world of Butler because this isn't the first time she actually touches on religion.
Right.
I love aspects of different religion throughout her work.
Yeah.
And so I really kind of want to touch on that. And so I'm talking to people so that I can do that for my next book. This dissertation, we are looking to get it published, but it will focus on more on establishing methodologies in the field of theopoetics, mm-hmm. but introducing Octavia Butler as an exemplar,
right.
what it means to be a theopoet, right? Mm-hmm. Or an artist who's working in that vein. And then the next book will solely be focused on just religion in her work, which isn't necessarily Christian religion.
Right.
I did find a thing where she talks about reading and writing religion. And I'm gonna see how long it is. She says, there comes a time for me within each of my novels when what I know from research becomes such a natural part of the story that I forget that I haven't always known it. In this case, I've been glancing through books of a number of actual religions. I needed a form for my character's religious book, and I worried about making her religion too much like one of the existing religions. I found that I liked the form of the Tao Te Ching, a slender little book with brief, simple, seemingly simple verses. I began to write my own, quite different, quiet little verses. I had written no poetry of any kind since I was in school, and even then I only wrote in utter duress. But time seems to have eased my resistance. The stuff I came up with at first was terrible, but it was fun to write, then to rework into something less terrible. The change of genre helped me break my block. In this article she's writing about writer's block. Suddenly, I was working on a novel in a whole different way, and it was intriguing. So she talks about a little bit about the history of the Civil War. She says, one of my early inspirations helped me move me along too, the news. The ugly things in the novels happen because today's dangers, drug use, illiteracy, the popularity of building prisons, coupled with the unpopularity of building and maintaining schools and libraries, the yawning rich-poor gap, and global warming, grow up to be tomorrow's disasters. And so as she begins writing, she says that, you know, she finds her voice. And so she talks about why it was so difficult to write these books, and thinking religiously was why. So she begins to look at different religions, and that's how she identifies New Age, all these different things. But she really kind of wrote her own. And I really do believe that a lot of the tenets that she wrote were tenets that she herself believed, even though she didn't aspire to. There's no written indication that I found that she actually aspires to Earthseed as of her own religious practice. Yes.
Oh,
I thought you were raising your hand. Other questions?
So how many years ago was it that you just took that time off and couch surfed?
2017. So it's only been a few years, and I've met some, you know, really cool people. What's interesting about Octavia Butler's work is the inspiration that it has gone on in culture. So I've actually encountered quite a few community activists whose work is solely based on Octavia Butler's work. So for those of you that are familiar with Adrienne Marie Brown, Emergent Strategies, Pleasure Activism, her notion of like shaping change and like shaping the world is based on the concept of shaping God by Butler, and she says this. This is one of her sole inspirations for writing. And when I was actually at the archives before everything shut down, there was a scholar who was from the UK who was studying activist groups in the UK and the influence on how they were influenced by feminist speculative fiction. And she had been hearing so much about activists who said that their sole inspiration for getting into activist work was Octavia Butler, that she had to come down to Pasadena to look at the archives to see what was so inspiring about her work. And so there's a huge movement in community activism that is solely because of the resonance of what Butler creates. Yes?
I did think of a question now.
Yeah, and then we'll come to the...
Yeah, so I'm a huge fantasy and science fiction person, and I'm trying to locate the idea of geopoetics, which I just learned about from you this week, next to my love of that whole genre. So my question, I guess, is what are your thoughts on, like, what makes a piece of science fiction geopoetical specifically? And can you even do science fiction without engaging in that activity? Or is it all of it, or is there some of it that is not, or what?
Yeah, I'm going to inverse that question. And I'm going to go back to a comment I made earlier this week when I said that theology is speculative fiction. Right? Let's go back to those three questions that help to orientate speculative fiction. If only, what if we continue? I want you to think about the way in which we think about God and the way in which we think about, even books of the Bible, right, are written like if only or if we continue, right? And so when we begin to think about theology as a symbiotic system, as a system of symbols, as a way in which we are really, you know, trying to create rhythms and, for lack of better words, rules that are based on how we understand God, how God acts in the world, and how that shapes the way we are to act with one another, right? It in a sense is speculative, right? When I say fiction, I think people think, you know, it's immediately false and that's danger of saying, you know, God is not real. No, I mean, how many stories have we read that have held more truth, right, than some of the, just the facts, the bullet point facts, right? And so when we begin to think about the relationship between theopoetics and science fiction, it's less about which science fiction work are theopoetics and more about in which ways is theopoetics speculative fiction. Does that make sense? So when I'm looking at a work, I'm not going, how is this a theopoetic? I think this one is a little easy because Butler enters into the religious theological conversation, right? She's specifically talking about and critiquing Christianity, and particular American Christianity. So it's not appropriating her against her will into a conversation. She has entered into it. But it's not the same to think through all of the science fiction works we love and to call them theopoetic. It's the notion of the speculation in the first place that we learn from as a new way to think about how we engage with God and one another. I'm going to go here, and I'm going to go back to you, Laura.
I'm interested in how you chose to study at Fuller.
Yeah.
And whether there are specific individuals there whose thinking attracted you, considering your process leading up to the decision to do a degree like that, and how they have also received your proposal about all of this.
Yeah, material. That is an excellent question. The short answer to the first part is Google. So I actually didn't know anything about theological education. I just knew I wanted to study theology. And I literally Googled seminaries in California. Because I wanted to stay local.
Yeah.
Fuller came up first, and so this is the first thing I clicked on. And they had their master's program in worship theology and the arts, and a doctoral program in theology and culture. And I said, oh, that's me, and I applied. Mm-hmm. And the turnaround between my submitting of my application and my being in my first class was literally a month.
Wow.
So I didn't know about really other schools or other notions. I didn't know evangelical, I didn't know what a Presbyterian was. I came into, you know how everybody does, thanks be to God, like, but that's not written on the screen, right? Everybody just knows to say that. So I'm looking around like, how did you know that that's what you're supposed to say? Like, I hadn't been in that kind of liturgical setting. I was completely lost. And so it was really, I think it was good for me to kind of learn in that mode. Fuller's, it's just a really interesting place. The reason I stayed for my doctoral program is because I met a professor there by the name of Bill Dernis, who is a Reformed theologian and writes on visual arts and poetic theology. And we just clicked, and he wanted me to study with him, and then found out he was retiring, and I wanted to take a gap year. So I kind of just let that dream go, and one gap year turned to two gap years. And then that summer, he came to me and said, excuse me, he came to me and said that he could take one more student, and please apply. And so I applied, and I got in, and I didn't know that he was holding his retirement for me.
Oh, no.
And so I am his last full-time student.
Oh,
wow. He knew nothing about Octavia Butler when we started, and neither did my second reader. Actually, I don't know. I don't think there were any of my professors that had actually read or heard of Octavia Butler, but immediately read it. So my committee is great. They've read Octavia Butler. They've read all kinds of books that I just like will randomly mention. And he's like, you know, I read that book. It was great. I'm going to add it to the syllabus or whatever. So they've been really great at like tracking and keeping track of Butler's work and theopoetic work. Even the director of the Writing Center, who is helping me with some edits, went to the Modern Language Association conference, who couldn't go that year, and actually sat in sessions on Butler and took notes for me. So there's been some incredible people. There's some people who don't know or understand what I am doing. Especially like Fuller is an interesting place, and I get a lot of questions at conferences. Usually either, sometimes people will see my name tag and then they'll turn around and walk away, which I get. But also I will get into conversations with people, have conversations like this, and they go, where are you? And then I say Fuller, and then their whole face is confusion. And they're like, how? And I'm like, Google. And they're just like, I don't understand that. And I'm like, we end up where we end up. But if I wasn't a Fuller, I would have been in Pasadena,
right?
To have access to the Huntington, because I did not plan on Octavia Butler being the focus. So it was really really a God moment how that happened for me. Yes, and then no.
So my science fiction genre, both focus of reading or appreciation is more on the dystopian side. So this question is maybe a little uneducated. Prefacing that. But would you say that the dystopian writings and science fiction perhaps might be more theopoetical than other genres within science fiction? The like different, I don't know. That, because like I'm thinking like Handmaid's Tale and other kinds of like 1984 and stuff like that, like religion just goes bad.
Right.
I mean, in a lot of those. And so I think that I'm just curious if those aren't just responses to what we how narrowly we sometimes can view God.
Yeah. No, I think that is a good question. It's not a question that I thought deeply about, so I'm going to kind of go off the cuff here, and I may disprove myself for the next 5 minutes. Who knows? I think I hesitate to say that dystopians are more theopoetic than those that are not dystopian, because when you're thinking about imagination as central in a theopoetic space, that doesn't always end in dystopia, right? That there is hope and liberation that is central to a theopoetic understanding. And so you can't restrict that only to dystopia. The reason that I think that Butler's work is different from other dystopias is because she utilizes religious, spiritual practices, right? To create kind of like a utopia within a dystopia.
Right, okay.
Right? Yeah. And so when I say Earthseed and the ways in which they endure community and communal life and the justice, I don't know if those who've read Parable of the Sower have also read Parable of the Talents, but their notion of like going towards justice, going and rescuing people from slavery, not having, right? And so the practices and the ethos that Earthseed is about in and of itself is theopoetic. In a way that I think that the world that Butler creates around that may not necessarily be.
Right, okay.
Like, so that's what I mean when I say that work is a theopoetic work.
The inner thoughts of
the so the inner thoughts of Earthseed particularly as a theopoetic. But I do want to get into more of the world of religion and literature, specifically science fiction. I'm really also fascinated, and I haven't been able to do any research behind this yet, on what happens when science fiction writers create religion. And I want to do an in-depth study on Octavia Butler and L. Ron Hubbard. And the notions of what happens when science fiction writers create religions and the trajectories that those take and how those trajectories could possibly be racialized and gendered and all of these different notions, right? And the intentions, right, behind them. Octavia Butler didn't go to make a religion. She was thinking about how to utilize religion for change, and in that, through her character, created something, right? And this is a very different story for L. Ron Hubbard. And so what do we think about when the artists create religion and the underpinnings of that and the trajectories of that? That's kind of like really what I'm going to be interested in next. But there's this little thing called a dissertation that I have to write. Other questions, comments? And these are things that we can open up about the whole week. You don't have to feel like you have to ask me a question about Octavia Butler. You can literally ask me anything.
Wow.
Anything except math. Please don't ask me anything.
You can just set those boundaries.
Yeah, just not numbers. Because I don't know. That's going to be my blanket answer.
This is a big can of worms. I'm a big part of I am part of the Tolkien community, like online and like fandom and stuff. And a big challenge for that community has been in our love for Tolkien and everything they've created, also working on, I guess what I would say is decolonizing that writing. And when it's been challenging for many to carry our identities into these like full-fledged worlds that people have created that reflect the injustices and biases that they brought to it. So I don't even know what my question is, but like, this is a real inspiring, like, I can't wait to read more Octavia Butler, but when I return to my favorites, who are a product of their time, whenever those were, have you thought about how to go into problematic spaces within science fiction and deal with those?
Yeah, so this is, I go back to the notion of why I say that imaginations are tethered. A good way to understand this is through a sculptor, Chris Sladoff, where he does his presentation. He does really awesome religious sculpture, huge stuff, like life size, right? And he always does a lecture in our Gospels class about doing the Gospels through the arts. And he talks about how when he was a kid and he would watch all of the old school Jesus films, or like the Ten Commandments, and he's watching it, and he's like, oh yeah, that's probably exactly what it looked like. And then years later, he's like, that looks so 80s. Oh my God, that is the 80s in a movie, right? And it's the notion that our imaginations are tethered to our context. So even as we imagine future, what the future looks like, we are still tethered down to the ways in which we understand things as a result of our contextual places. And so this is important to know in science fiction, because science fiction is all about imagining the future, the what ifs, the, you know, the beyond reality, right? And so when you get a person saying, I can't put a black person in a thing because it complicates it all, it's because his imagination is tethered in a white supremacist kind of notion that the only way you could talk about black people is as racialized non-humans.
Like orcs.
Right, and so they become the stand-in for aliens without actually being humanized as people, because in reality, in your context, that's the only way you can think of it. So that limits the context of your imagination. So when black people and other people of color and other people under oppression are writing their own imaginative, futuristic works, they are writing themselves in, right? And so it becomes an act of their own resistance, because by writing myself in as a whole person with complexities, right, I am now shifting the imagination, and by shifting the imagination, I'm having people question the ways in which they think in their present context. So there's that aspect. One other thing to think through is Octavia's Brood. It is a set of short stories that is edited by Adrienne Marie Brown and another person whose name I can't think of. Apologize to that person. But it's written by activists who are not science fiction writers, not all of them anyway, and they're writing science fiction in the vein of Butler about their issue. So whatever area or community they're seeking to find justice for, they write it in the vein of science fiction. And so this helps them to shape and to understand not only their untethered imaginations, but to utilize how imagination can help and how narrative can help people to understand what they are trying to do in a new light. And so there's all of these different complexities and entries. When it comes to things like Tolkien and Lovecraft, so this is where Lovecraft Country comes in. Has anybody seen Lovecraft Country? H.P. Lovecraft was a huge, prolific science fiction writer that is often critiqued about his white supremacy and all some of the other works that he's done. And so another science fiction writer came along and wrote this book called Lovecraft Country, which is really hard to say when you're talking, and basically expresses, basically outwardly tackles the notion of race in Lovecraft's works. And so that book was then adapted as a TV series on HBO. And so it would be things like, you know, there are monsters and all these different things that are akin to Lovecraft kind of world. But, you know, when they come in to two main black characters who are about to be lynched by a series of people because they're in a sundown town. Does anybody know what that means? Mm-hmm. Sundown town means that for black people, you can be outside after sundown, because white people have free reign to do whatever they want with you. So you better be gone by the time the sun is down, right? And so now they're in this thing where they got caught, and then the monsters come and eat all the white people. And they're just like, I mean, they're still scared, but it's just like, okay, and then they like run. So it's using the notions of race as a critique to Lovecraft, but also as a critique to race within science fiction. It's a phenomenal show on HBO. I highly commend it to you. It's also, there is also a syllabus. Somebody wrote a syllabi for each of the episodes, which helps you understand a lot of the terms and the notions and the things that were happening contextually in that time as it relates to that episode. So there's a way for you to kind of learn a whole lot about history and race. Is that a question I forgot? No, I'm just
no, that, I mean, that was a great answer. I, yeah. I think it was like, I didn't get it. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Any other questions or comments? Yes and yes.
So I have a question. It's more from like the first day. You talked about the theopoetics and how it can, I don't know if you use the word embrace, but embrace also atheism and the spectrum of atheism. And I'm wondering how, you know, I just want you to speak a little more to that on how you think that theopoetics does embrace atheists. And if you see that in some way theopoetics can bring together people of religion, whether whatever religion it is, and atheists into a space where they meet and they're not so excluded.
Yeah. So what she's referring to is the first day where we talked about one of the influences of theopoetics, and that is the Death of God movement. The Death of God movement in the 60s, think of the Time magazine, Is God Dead? And all of the notions in which radical theologians, as they call themselves, believed that God was alive at one point, but then God died, and now God no longer is alive. Let's just throw the whole thing away. Christianity, blah, we need to move on. When it was written in 1968, it could be 66, is it even now? It talked about the 10 tenets of the radical theology movement, the first being that there was never a God. There is no God, there was never a God, all the way down to the way in which we think about God needs to change, and we need renewal within church to understand, to truly understand God. Like, the way we understand God needs to die. That doesn't mean that God is dead, it just means that we need to be revived, right? As it relates to that, theopoetics came as another way to understand interactions with the divine in life. Like, if God is dead, now what? Right, and theopoetics became that path after the now what. As it relates to atheism, so there are, you know, a lot of atheists who are engaged in conversation about religion. I think it's really interesting whether or not you think about believing in some kind of iteration of God or not believing God at all or believing in science or what have you. I still think that it shapes the way we understand the world, the human condition, the earth, the way we interact with each other. And I think there is where theopoetics can be helpful, right? Because theopoetics lends to a sense of a, like I said, it's an articulating of sensibilities. And those sensibilities help us to establish rhythms and practices of engagement. And so for a person who may not believe that there is a deity, right, but they may believe in the aspect of science, then how does that shape the way, it still shapes the way that they understand the human condition. So how do we talk about that? And so there have been some spaces where we either have people that have moved into atheism from a certain type of Christianity, less people who have been atheists their whole life, who actually do engage and come to spaces of theopoetics, the conference, what have you, to have conversation about what does that reality mean for us, right? There are also humanists and other people who have moved away from Christianity that still talk about the need, the necessity to engage in theological language. A really interesting book on that would be Anthony Penn. He is a scholar, African-American scholar, does a lot with black theology, a lot with the origins and culture of hip-hop. But during the time of him teaching and writing prolifically, he became a humanist. And there's a memoir and he talks about it, but there's a future book he talks about, which is called The End of God Talk. And he argues for a really long, he should come up with a better name for this, but he argues for African-American, non-theistic, humanist theology. right, in which he says that even though God is a symbol we no longer need use of, there is something about theological language, right, the talking about something beyond, and he determines that beyond is like beyond ourselves, like beyond the person, like what exists between us, right? Theological language is still helpful for us to talk about and work through those things, right? And so there's still a sect of people who are humanists or atheists who will use theological language and concepts to kind of talk about the human condition. And so that may be spaces where theopoetics can help people navigate. Is that?
That does answer. Okay. That's very helpful. And one other quick question on the in ARC, you talked about how there were not just Christians, but other religious figures there. Are there any humanists or atheists in that organization?
Yes. I'm trying to think back to the last conference, but the last conference was supposed to be 2020, so I'm messing up all of my time. Yes, there are a few, probably a lot more within the process theology track. And then also you would count some of those pyro theologists, so think John Caputo, think Peter Rollins. They're also on a track that is connected to theopoetics. So there is some structure. More and more, as theopoetics is becoming more of a name, but there are people who are already kind of there, but just haven't been introduced to the term itself yet. And then you had a question?
Well, and mine's more personal. I'd like to know a little bit about your own story.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've already covered it in earlier sessions. This is unfortunately the first time I've felt awake enough.
No, trust me, after lunch is a hard sell. Yeah, I know. But my anything particularly, I mean, I could start from
your
beginning.
Childhood. I mean,
it's 1982.
But I mean, your evolution sort of, you know, I call when I've had experiences where I look back and I go, okay, well, there was a time I had, you know, the Sunday school kind of for a sense of God in my life. And then, so I call any time my sense of God is expanded, I say it's, you know, it's God out of the box. I mean, whenever I have, you know, a parameter around God, I realize, you know, that's too small.
Yes.
I have a friend that always says, my God's too small. I mean, this isn't. So I'm curious about your own, you know, upbringing and the senses of when you begin to have the ahas. And
yes, I will answer you in a true theopoetic fashion with a poem. So I wrote this poem actually as an assignment for my creative preaching class, and I got a B, but then the poem got published, so. So this poem actually is an answer to the assignment, which the question was, who is God? I will say, for those of you who have the ears for it, this poem exclusively uses masculine pronouns for God. I thought about changing it later on, but then I realized that at the time that I was in these different iterations, the only pronouns I knew for God were masculine pronouns. And so I wanted to be true to both where I was theologically as I was growing up, and also true to the notions in which I did need God so many times in my life to be Father. And so I kept the pronouns as he, but I don't mean that in any kind of way that God is exclusively he. So I always get that preference. But this poem is called, Who is God? At age 5, he is the best answer for Sunday school questions. At age 8, he is the person you give your life to. Although the lady called him Jesus. At age 13, he is the only one who will listen to what you have to say. And at age 16, he is the last word you use when cursing and the first name you call on when you're about to get into trouble. At age 18, he is the voice that consoles a broken heart. And at 20, he is the grace that gives you room to forgive yourself. From 22 to 25, he becomes the reason for your hatred, the basis on which you claim your judgment, and the source of your pride. But at 26, you realize he was none of those things, and you wonder if you ever really knew him at all. So at 28, you set out on a journey to find him, like a child obsessed with capturing their parents' shadow. And at 30, you realize the sun is east, the day is new, and he was right beside you all along, in his shadow, constantly propelling you forward into newness. He is the mystery of your life simply because he is the only thing that makes sense. He is your foundation, whether recently rediscovered or newly found, I cannot say. But he is the only support strong enough for your ambitiously ignorant, insightfully blinded steps that you carelessly choose to take. And although there will be many things that you will call him in the many years that you continue to discover, he is and always will be God. And I think looking back on that work, I got a B because I think my professor wanted me to make really big, grandiose statements about who God was, right? God is the everlasting presence that, right? And I think this really solidifies a lot of what Theo Portis has been talking about, and even what Chastity has been talking about the experience. Like, I can't tell you that God is this omnipotent, like, that's what I learned in Sunday school, yeah. I can't tell you that definitively, though. But I can tell you at age 5, he was this. I can tell you how I experienced God, you know, in all these different iterations. And I think that this is, a lot of this is autobiographical, right? But it's also the notion that the way that I will continue to discover God is through my own experience, and as such, through people like the people in this room, right? And that will begin to shape the notions of who I am and how I create God. And so, the reason that I start there is because my mom was my first theologian. I didn't grow up in church. I didn't grow up in church. My mom was going to church when I was younger, and she went to like a Pentecostal church. And she would tell me stories of when she was pregnant with me, she was at a revival. Exciting, I know. And she received the gift of the Holy Spirit when she was pregnant with me. And the revivalists that had come to their church gave her and me a prophetic word. She never told me what he said to her, which I'm kind of curious. But she would always say that he prayed over me in her belly and said that the words, knowledge and wisdom, all the days of her life, were written across my forehead. Mm-hmm. And so that is a story that I grew up with about God, right? And so I learned about, like, how to pray, and about gospel music, and seeing all of the ways in which my mom leaned on God for all this stuff that she had gone through. That was my first way of learning about God. And so when I would write, which I started writing very early because I was a quiet kid and I didn't know how to talk to people, so I write everything down. I would write in my diary, Dear God. Like, I didn't have a dear diary. Like, God was the only person who had to talk to. And so that deep spirituality began to really shape who I was as a kid. I was also a nerd. I'd stayed in and I read books. And so that kind of shaped my trajectory, you know, this deep spirituality and also this deep desire for knowingness. And I don't, you know, it's kind of like, how did you become in PhD? Was it because the prophecy was true? Mm-hmm. Or was it because the story that my mom told me about the prophecy shaped so much of who I am? That it allowed me to be that person that really was open to receive knowledge and wisdom all the days of her life, right? But I think that my mom's spirituality, even still, is a huge influence and has, I think, more resonance than any of the churches that I grew up in. That I went to as I was older, because I didn't go to church when I was a kid. Although my mom did say that I would want to go to church some days when I was little, and then she'd say, we're not going, and then she says, I don't believe her. She says that I would throw tantrums in the living room because I wanted to go to church. Uh-huh. So then she dressed me up and then sent me with the neighbor. And so that's how I would go to Sunday school. So spirituality and knowledge have always been like the things that I knew I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to, since I was younger in high school, I had all these things that I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to start my own college. Well, start my own college. It's weird, right? I don't know why I did. I just always wanted to. So that's still a dream. I knew I wanted to get a PhD. I didn't know what. I know I was just going to be a nerd. I suppressed it for a while because I thought all my brothers and sisters were the cool kids. And I wanted to be a cool kid, and then I quickly realized I'm not the cool kid. So then I just embraced my nerddom, and I've been embracing it ever since. Yes.
I don't know what you're going to do after your PhD, but I just, I hope that you will be teaching in the theology school somewhere. Because I wish that if I were 35 or 40 years younger, that I could come to your class. And no, seriously. I mean, I'm just, you have a gift, and I just, it's exciting to think about you as a theology teacher in a major seminary somewhere.
Oh, yes, thank you. You know, I do love teaching. I don't know how much I love teaching in seminary, but I do want to teach. I think I'm also just obsessed with wanting to teach also in spaces like this, because I don't really want to talk big words to academics all day, because why? It feels so boring to me. Like, this is where all the good stuff. When people come and be like, I don't know what the heck you're talking about. Like, how does this apply to the thing I got to go do tomorrow? Yeah. Like,
well, but when you teach people actually preparing for not grad school, but I mean for preparing for ministry. So you know, like an MDiv program. Those are your you know, more feet on the ground people. I mean, and so that idea of, because I mean, the church is dying and being reborn, I mean, in some ways, and who knows what, you know, the new forms, and I just think this is so relevant to that, and because, I mean, it's just, that's just what's happening, I think, in Lutheran circles, is, you know, that just totally trying to reimagine, what does it mean to be, you know?
Yeah, and that's what I really feel like my calling is. So Fuller does this thing for, it's part of his integration, and said it asks this question that you got to memorize, because it asks you 50 million times, and I could help facilitate some of the groups. But it's, at this point in your Christian journey, how do you envision your mission in what God is doing in the world? So where do you see yourself at this point? And I always encourage people to not to necessarily think of a job. Right? I see myself being a pastor in a place of, no. Always think, ask them to think of some kind of an image or metaphor. So if a person says, I'm a bridge, I feel like I'm really called to build bridges, right? If they're in a context in which it's not the ideal job that they thought that they were going to get, but they know that part of their calling is to kind of build bridges, and they can begin to see, okay, what is needing to be connected here? How can I be a bridge builder? And so images and metaphors give the flexibility to move into spaces and to navigate the unknown. So I always say, I am a sacred astronaut. So just to be called to build spaces where people have the opportunity and permission to reimagine.
Yeah, and we don't even know, we really don't know where we're going. I mean, you know, in one ultimate sense, maybe, you're just going out into space.
Yeah, and you don't know. And part of that is the floating and the wandering. And part of that is, you know, having some direction, going like speed and going in planets. And I need to stop watching TV. But, you know, it's all part of it, right? And so if we have spaces where we have the permission to reimagine, then I think that can lead into some really fun, cool, generative ways of just being. It is after 3, so I will say thank you.
Thank you.